So I'm very excited to have Jonathan Hayek joining me on the show. And before I want to tee up your introduction, Jonathan, actually, because I've had the opportunity to chat with you before and I've listened to another one of your podcasts. So if you don't mind, let me tee up your intro. But first, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I don't know that I've ever done a live podcast interview like this with guests, and so it's really cool to see some faces and to be here.
I love it for the reason that people will ask questions that I hadn't thought about. And anytime you have an opportunity to hear how someone else was inquisitive on something that gets brought up, I always learn from it as well. So I love the live format. So thank you for agreeing to do this. So I know, like I said, I know a little bit about you. You were a special ed teacher. You had bought a, I believe you bought a condo that was a bit of a flop. You took a hiatus from investing in real estate. You got back into it, flipping houses. You were able to actually transition full time into being a real estate investor. And then you started getting into commercial and industrial. And industrial is obviously what we're going to focus on mostly. Is that a fair summary of your background up to where we are today?
It is, and you've clearly done your research. You brought up an obscure deal, my first condo deal from 16 years ago at least. So yeah, that is a fair summary of my intro.
Well, let's pick it up right back there, because I think a lot of people, myself was the same. I had originally started investing in residential many years ago, took a break as well, and then I've exclusively got back into industrial investing. But I think a lot of people will have that foundation for their real estate journey by being in residential. So let's pick it up right there. You've bought and sold some houses, done some flips, invested in residential, and then you decided to go into commercial, presumably multifamily and industrial. So what was the process from being an experienced residential investor to then deciding that you wanted to go in a different direction?
For me, it started with goals. So I started my working career as a special ed teacher and was really living paycheck to paycheck. And I wanted more freedom. It was ultimately about freedom for me. It was not about building the biggest business possible or buying the biggest deal possible. So this conversation might be a little bit different than with some of your other guests. I'm not going to talk to you about how many millions of square feet of industrial that I own. Instead, largely what my message is going to be is what real estate can do for you. And for me, I'm a lifestyle investor. And so real estate, and specifically industrial real estate right now, is providing lifestyle freedom for me. And so residential real estate was a way, I didn't know it at the time, but I know this in hindsight. Residential real estate was a way for me to build up some capital. I was a teacher. I had $0 to my name. I was living paycheck to paycheck. And so I started flipping houses and using the capital from house flips to buy small multifamily properties. And I thought I was going to buy this empire of small multifamily properties, 2 units, 3 units, 4 units, until I realized how much work and how much management residential properties really are. And all of us on this call probably have some idea about how much work residential properties are. And so my first commercial deal was actually an office building. I thought that was a natural transition from multifamily to non-residential deals. And so I bought this empty office building, and I thought it would be much the same as multifamily. And so I thought, hey, I'm just going to lease this up with business owners in the community that need an office. And so it was a little more complicated than that. It did end well. It took longer than I thought it would. But I just needed to do that one office deal to know that I did not need to do any more office deals. And I was hooked on the non-residential aspect of it, but I was looking for more passive, less management intensive options. This was a multi-tenant office building, not quite as much work as a multi-tenant apartment building, but still a good amount of management involved. And so my next deal after that office building was a single tenant industrial property. And this was a net lease deal with below market rents, expiring lease, great location with great metrics, supply demand imbalance, and that was it's been a great deal for me. And so now I'd like to build an empire of those single tenant net lease industrial properties.
Yeah, I think you're spot on with that. I think that that is the natural trajectory for people that want to get into commercial, is that they had experience in residential, so then they try to scale with multifamily. Once the management burden catches up, then they start looking at commercial and they see retail or they see office buildings. Industrial, for the most part, becomes something literally and figuratively tucked away in an industrial park, out of mind, out of purview. It's not something that a lot of people gravitate to, but when they do, for the reasons that you mentioned, it becomes quite attractive. Question for you, because this is what a lot of people ask, is how did you learn about industrial to have the confidence to go and make that first investment?
So I started learning about real estate through some mentors, and there was a kind of a broker mentor of mine locally. I've done most of my investing in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and so I met and met a great broker, did lots of deals with this broker, and he was just a few steps ahead of me, and finding that person was so important. So whether it was that person specifically for me or for someone else, just finding someone that's a few steps ahead of you that can kind of show you the path a little bit, tell you about some mistakes that they've made, tell you about some things to watch out for. And so that person, his name is James, and I still do deals with him as my broker. And then I also started my own podcast. And so I was trying to learn how to do these types of deals. And, as many of us know, there are just so few places to learn about non-residential commercial real estate. If you want to learn about multifamily, there are 1.5 million podcasts that you can go listen to learn from multifamily syndicators, and that's great. But if you're interested in industrial or just non-residential asset classes, there are so few places to learn. And so, since it was something I really wanted to learn, I created my own podcast and I targeted the guests that I wanted to learn from. And so that podcast has been instrumental. LinkedIn has been instrumental. I am a member of a commercial real estate mastermind that has been helpful. So really trying to surround myself with people that are in some cases a few steps ahead of me, in some cases 100 steps ahead of me, so I can learn from their mistakes, ask them questions, and be able to get to the next step on my journey.
Well, and that next step on your journey will be helping others get to where you are, because there's a lot of people. I know people in this group that want to invest in industrial real estate, but they haven't yet. So I think that you could provide that information to that next group coming up as well. So explain a little bit more about the deal that you bought, just so to put that in context, because I'd like to just drill in a little bit more on that. But if you could just share some more info about that property.
Sure. This is a property. It's located in Oklahoma City. It's a single tenant property with so the building itself is 8,750 square feet. The front portion of that, about 1,500 square feet, is office. The back portion is all warehouse, and the tenant is a landscaping company. There's also a good amount of side yard. The whole building itself sits on about 1.5 acres of land. And so a good amount of outdoor storage. Some of that is covered, some of that is uncovered. And so this was actually the first real out-of-state deal that I ever did. When I bought it, I was living in Cheyenne, Wyoming at the time, and this deal's in Oklahoma City. And so there was a little bit of a resistance of investing out of market for me. But I was able to get over that. And I can tell you a little bit as we go on about how I got over some resistance of investing out of market for me. But that the specs on that property really fit my buy box and really fit my current buy box of the kind of deals that I'm still looking at. And so it's occupied. I currently do not buy vacant properties. It's just too much risk for me right now. So it was occupied with a great tenant. So it's a regional tenant. It's a regional landscaping company. They operate in 12 or 15 different states. So Solid Tenant, they do hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue per year. And they had been in this location. This building had never been vacant. The seller built it for himself about 30 years ago. He had his own landscaping business. He sold his landscaping business to the current tenant. The current tenant is called Landcare, and they do commercial landscaping. And so he sold his business to the current tenant, and he maintained ownership of the real estate. And so now, approximately 30 years later, he was quite a bit older and he was ready to sell the property. And so it had an expiring lease. It had, when I took it over, it had about 6 months left on the lease. Below market rents, the lease was 20 years old. So I think they had maybe an original 10-year lease with a few extensions. And so rent was approximately 40% below market value. It was at $6 a foot. Market is right about $10 a foot. And so this it really checks all the boxes of value add deals that I'm looking for. An expiring lease, and so a lot of other investors are scared off by an expiring lease, below market rents, and then not to mention it also had a dirty phase one environmental report, and so that also scared off some other buyers. And so I was able to come in with an aggressive offer and was able to take that down and was able to renew the tenant to market rents with great increases into a 5-year lease with an option. And I still own it, and it's just a great cash flowing property with a net lease out of state. I don't hear anything from the tenant. I send him an email every once in a while to say hello, but other than that, it's just a really great low management cash flowing property for me.
Yeah, it reminds me very closely of one property that I own with a few partners. It's roughly the same size. I think ours is about 15,000 square feet on 3 acres, single tenant building. I haven't been to the property in 2 years myself, because it is just that hands off. So I love this type of asset class. There's that perception with industrial real estate is that you need to be owning an Amazon fulfillment center, or you need to have Home Depot as a tenant. And that is a big section of the market, but that's mostly institutional grade ownership. There's a tremendous amount of opportunity in this, call it like 1 to 5 to $10 million worth of asset value. That makes a lot of sense, where you can own it being in a different city and not have to worry about a residential tenant flooding the toilet at midnight and having to deal with all of that. It's, as you mentioned, the management aspect of it is so much more minimized. I know a question came in from Richard, and it's probably the exact same question I had, because when you said it had a dirty phase one, that's always a scary thought to me. So Richard asked, and Rob asked too. I'll get to you guys' questions in 1 second. I just want to flesh out this environmental point. So I think most people will be pretty familiar with the phase one, phase two perspective, but I'm assuming on your phase one, it just said further testing was recommended, so you had to go to a phase two. Or what happened? Did you get a phase two?
Yes, I did.
So did the phase two come back with contamination?
No.
Okay.
And let me and if I can, I can tell you a little bit about my thinking through that environmental process. So I went through the first round. This was purchased in the summer, I guess just last summer 2023. Spring 2023. There were multiple offers on the property. I think most of the offers were from owner users. I know one of at least one was a competing landscaping company, and I'm sure they intended to kick this landscaping company out so they could try to increase some market share. But the origin I did not originally win the contract. I was outbid by someone else. And so then about 3 weeks later, the broker that I submitted the offer with came back to me and said, "Hey, this deal's falling out of contract. Are you still interested?" I said, "Yes." So then at that point, they said the reason it fell out of contract was because the phase one had some issues and the previous buyer didn't want to go through a phase two. They didn't want to take on that risk. So I said, "Okay, let me look at the phase one." So I looked at the phase one, and the issues were, this is Oklahoma City, and so there's of course oil fields at one point in history. And so at one point there were oil storage tanks on site. And then there were also some neighboring properties that I guess the environmental engineers just had some questions about. I think one of the neighboring properties was like a car junkyard, something like that. And we were maybe my property is slightly downgrade from that junkyard. And so the environmental engineer just said, you know, we should take a look at this. And so I had a conversation with the environmental engineer. I said, you know, what are we looking at? How often do you see this type of thing? What are the risks that I'm looking at? What are the costs of the phase two? Those types of things. And so when I make decisions, everything is a calculated risk for me. And so he estimated that the phase two would cost, it was somewhere between $3,000 and $3,500. I think the final total came back lower than that, was more like $2,500. But he said, I'm not anticipating any issues with this. I see this all the time. It's Oklahoma. There used to be oil fields everywhere. But because of the potential risk of contamination in the past, we have to do a phase two. We have to do some bores and test it. He said, if you were planning on knocking this down to build a residential subdivision, there might be, you might have some more concerns about contamination levels. He said, but the factors and the different metrics required with this zoning allow for higher levels of contamination. Not that we want any contamination, but he said if there is something, the chances of the levels of contamination being out of range for this type of zoning is very unlikely. He said, I'm really confident that we're going to do the bores and it's going to come back fine. And I'll give you, you know, I'll. There will be no wrecks anymore, and you'll have a clean environmental. And so I did that. And so it was calculated risk. So I was like, okay, $3,500. If nothing else, it's going to be a lesson for me. And so we went through with the phase two. Everything came back clean. I got a clean phase two with no wrecks. And I was willing to go through with it because I felt like it was a great deal. It was exactly the kind of property that I wanted. And if it didn't work out, $3,500, a $3,500 lesson. I was willing to do that, but the environmental engineer was correct, and it turned out fine, and was no issue.
How many boreholes did they have to do on that? It was about an acre.
I think they took maybe 6 or 8 boreholes from different parts of the land of the property. They I guess they had some drawings and they could estimate where the previous storage tanks were approximately located. And so they did some samples in the general direction. I wasn't there when they did it, but they took some samples in the areas where they believe the previous storage tanks were.
It's crazy how much discrepancy there is in pricing. I'm in Canada and we see on average $6,000 to $8,000 per borehole. So to do a phase two of that magnitude could be 20 grand, 25 grand, 30 grand very easily. So to hear that they did that many boreholes for 3,500 is a huge price gap between other markets. So that $3,500 lesson, even though you didn't have to pay it because it worked out for you, that still would have been much less than doing a phase two here and spending a $30,000 lesson. So that was definitely good. Let's get to a couple of the questions because I think that these are all great questions to ask. So Richard, two questions. First one, we'll start with this. Did you finance the deal?
It was a cash purchase. That's what made my offer attractive to the seller. But it was purchased some of my own cash, some of investor cash. And so to the seller, it was a cash deal. To me, I do have some lending on it with family and friends.
Did you go through a similar underwriting process as a bank would have done?
Can you clarify? What
Well,
like yeah, like what do you mean?
I'd say from a level that if a bank wants to, or if a bank will finance on it, they'll typically want to see an environmental report that doesn't have any further recommendations. They'll want to see some sort of building condition assessment. Sometimes it's called a property condition report in other markets, but an engineered report or study on the building. And then they'll also want to see an appraisal. And then they essentially will take all of that, underwrite it in terms of the borrower's capacity to borrow. And that's a very oversimplification of the process, but I did want to see all those reports. And it sounds like you did the environmental. So did you do an inspection on the building and an appraisal as well?
Yes, yeah, so my lenders didn't require anything, but me personally, I know that I am going to be refinancing the property, and so one day I will get lending, and so I knew that I wanted a clean building. I wasn't looking for a risky purchase, and so yeah, so that's why I did the environmental study. I did an on-site visit. We did all the inspections. We did roofing inspections, plumbing, electrical, sewer scope. I did not do an appraisal because I felt really good about the property I was buying, and the value that I was going to be adding. And so I didn't feel the need to do an appraisal, but I did treat the rest of it as if I was going to be getting financing moving forward. And I mean, I've got family and friends lending on this deal, and so I want to make sure that I'm buying a quality property for their sake as well to protect their interests.
Absolutely. When so it's a 30-year-old building, is that when you said that?
Approximately.
Okay. So I'm guessing some of the components are going to be at the end of the useful life, like the roof, if it hadn't been replaced, that's probably getting to the stage of it. There's probably some other issues creeping up. How did you plan or allocate capital budget to address some of these issues as they arise?
Yeah, so I have an operating account. I started with a $50,000 operating account. To your point, the roof is not original, but it is going to need, roofs need work. And Oklahoma gets hail. And so I'm anticipating that the roof is going to need some work in the next few years. And so from the start, I set up just a $50,000 operating account. My rent also goes into that account. And I don't think I'm taking any distributions from that. And so that is building up. Other than that, some of the other components that I'm potentially responsible for, HVAC, I had HVAC inspected, and that's good to go. I split, this was a negotiating piece with the tenant on the new lease. We split HVAC replacement costs 50-50. And so there is potential down the line of having to come out of pocket for HVAC replacement. And so, yeah, so I mean, it's hard to anticipate, exactly what's going to go wrong. That's the name of real estate. But I do have that kind of cushion, operating expense account for when things go wrong.
Yeah, that's a very important piece. Another question from Richard. How much did you bump their rent when the lease expired?
Yeah, this was the first large kind of commercial property that I negotiated the lease on. I did lease negotiations on my office building. Those were small and kind of inconsequential. But this one, I may have made a mistake, and I would love to get your feedback on how you would have handled this. So rent was originally $6 a foot. Market was close to $10 a foot. And so I was trying to get them up to $10 a foot. And I also, this being my first industrial property, I also didn't want vacancy. I was a little bit nervous of vacancy. I felt confident that they were going to stay. But there's always that tension of like, well, what if they don't? And then I'm left with this big empty building. So I offered to renew their lease at 7 years, $10 a foot. They said, we don't do 7-year leases. We only do 5-year leases. And so I said, okay, we'll do a 5-year lease. And they said, jumping 40% from $6 a foot to $10 a foot is too much. Can we go slower? So they wanted to go up from 6 to 10 over the course of 5 years. So eventually I got them up to market rate in 3 years. And so there's, the first year there was like a 20% bump and then a 15% bump and then another 10% bump. And so in hindsight, that may not have been the smartest way to go because what happened was it lowers the year one NOI, which reduces the value of the property when I want to go to refinance it. And so that was a challenge when I went to refinance it because they saw the rent bumps in eventually year three and year four, but they said, but right now the DSCR isn't getting us to where we need to be. And so Chad and anyone else in the audience, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this tension when you need to make a significant rent increase, doing it over the course of a couple years, trying to do it in 1 year and risking having that tenant leave, doing it in 1 year and maybe giving some other concessions to the tenant. How would you handle that?
Yeah, it's such a great topic because there is no easy answer on it. Different investors will have different appetites for risk. There might be someone that goes and buys it and says, well, if you guys want to move out, move out. The market is $10 a square foot. I'll just lease it. And if it takes me 6 months to do it, then that's what it's going to take me. I'm more on your side where I'm a very risk-averse investor where I'd rather lease it below market if necessary to keep that cash flow in there, not have any downtime. So I would personally be interested in negotiating more favorably to keep that tenant in there. I'm big on NOI as well because the NOI, you capitalize it, you've got an indication of value, it works on your DSCR, it works on everything. Well, that net NOI is such an important number that I probably would have found or I would have looked for, maybe it wasn't available, but I would have looked for something that I could have offset to give them an advantage so that I could have kept that NOI high. So perhaps front-loading them with 3 months of free rent. Here's 3 months of free rent. That'll lessen the blow. You can extrapolate this out over the first 3 years and see how that's going to lower your NOI. It's the same deal, but this allows me to keep the valuation high so I can get that financing or whatever it is. So that I probably would have looked to see other areas. Can I spend some money on your space? Can I make some cosmetic upgrades for you? Make the space more usable? Is there something I can spend a little bit more money on instead of giving that lower NOI? And a lot of big institutional clients, Lorraine, who's I see she's on here. She used to work for a large industrial real estate trust. Congratulations to Lorraine. I saw that she just actually moved positions. So convenient seeing you on here. She'd echo it as well, is that the big owners, they're so protective of the NOI. Like that is just what drives everything for good reason. And it's the same with me as a smaller investor. So I that's what I would have personally done is just, what can you do? Can you give them 1 month of free rent a year? As that might be aggressive. That's 5 months of free rent over a 5 year term. But if you give them 1 month of free rent, but now you can take your NOI to that $9, $10 a square foot, it's just that everything, even though it's just a moving paper. But that's one of the things that we've been successful doing on that. So we'll see if anyone else has, any questions? So Larray said, yeah, REITs tend to prioritize NOI versus rates, low cost too versus buying up rates. That's a term that we hear all the time, is like buying up rates. They want that NOI, so they're going to push the cost per square foot. And the lever that gets pulled on the other side is perhaps free rent or tenant improvement allowance or something that's incentivizing them to pay those rates. If anyone else has anything to add to that, please step in. Rob asked, did you get the lease extended before closing? And it sounds like you didn't. What was the general consensus? Because you didn't have financing at that time. What was the consensus from your investment group on potentially having that space go vacant when you closed?
From my lenders, I mean, for lack of a better word, they're unsophisticated. They're friends and family. They trust me. They're not looking at the deal. They're looking at me. And so I sign a mortgage and I sign a promissory note with my lenders. And so they know I'm good for it. I can't sell the building without paying them off. I also generally don't take on investors that I cannot pay myself. And so I'm not borrowing more money than my net worth. I'm not, the monthly payments that I'm paying there, their distributions, I could cover myself even without this building. And so I do try to make really safe, take on investors in a really safe situation. And so these are investors that bank on me, and yeah, they trust me. And so regarding the lease, even from my resident from my time doing residential, whenever tenants find out there's going to be a new owner, at least in the, I don't know about in the institutional world, but in this space, there are a lot of nerves and anxiety because there are so many unknowns. When I went to do this the on-site visit with this tenant, the first so I did the visit with my broker, with the listing broker, and with the general manager of this location. And the first thing the tenant says is, "What are you doing with the building?" They think they're losing their place of work. They think I'm gonna they think there's a chance that I'm gonna come in. Maybe I'm a competitor. Maybe I have my own business and I want the building and I'm gonna kick them out. And so there was high anxiety and high nerves with the tenant. And so the first thing I did was reassure them that I want you to stay. I'm an investor. I buy these types of properties, for the investment, and I'm looking for great tenants. And I know you all are a great tenant, and so I want you to stay. And so that right there, it just it reduced the anxiety. I could tell there was a weight off. She could take a deep breath, and then we could have a conversation. As we toured the property, then she was more open about talking about the property, about their operations, their busy season, how the building is functioning, those types of things. And so, in that visit, I had a conversation about what they wanted. Do you all want to stay? How does this building work for you? Would you like to see any changes with the building? Those types of things. And so I did not get the lease extension while under contract, but the negotiation started almost immediately, after I closed on it. I think I closed in June. Their lease expired at the end of September, October, something like that. And so negotiations, excuse me, they had a 6-month notification period, and so they had to notify me by like September, October. And so we started negotiations pretty quickly. And so they were very clear that they wanted to stay. They have, in their busy season, I think they have almost 100 employees that operate out of this location, seasonal workers. And so that's, one thing that I really love about this asset class is it's not just like an apartment that someone's renting. This is someone's livelihood, and not just one person's, but potentially dozens or even 100 or more people's livelihoods. And so this is not just like some flippant decision that management is making on whether or not to stay here. These are decisions that impact tons of people as their employment and their livelihood. And so that's, one reason that these tenants are so sticky in these locations. And so that's a little bit more about the lease situation.
Yeah, it really is the wheels of commerce, seeing these industrial buildings, and there's so many different types of uses, and you really do get a sense of how the economy is so dependent on the industrial real estate sector. It's another reason why I love it so much too. Just before we go, Jonathan, you've got a podcast. Can you tell people where they can find the podcast, and then what's best to connect with, LinkedIn and your website, anything else you can share?
Yeah, the podcast is called The Source of Commercial Real Estate. It's a weekly interview-based podcast. Chad is going to be on it, I think the first week of May, about a month from now. And we already did the interview, but it'll go up in May. And it's focused on non-residential commercial real estate. So we really don't talk about multifamily. We talk about office, retail, industrial, with brokers, investors, lenders, attorneys. And just trying to get into the weeds of non-residential commercial real estate. So you can connect with me on that podcast. I'm also somewhat active on LinkedIn. So Jonathan Hayek, Hayek is my last name, and love talking about commercial real estate. So would be happy to talk with anyone.
Perfect. We'll put all of that in the show notes and I'd encourage people to reach out to you. I know that there's brokers here, there's investors here, there might be people that just want to reach out and ask you questions. So I'd encourage you to connect with Jonathan. And once again, thank you for taking the time to do this. A fascinating conversation. You and I are very aligned in how we see the future and what we're optimistic about. So always a pleasure getting to chat with you. Thanks for sharing all your insights and wisdom.
Thank you so much for having me, Chad.
Okay, thanks everyone. Take care and we'll talk to you soon.